As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our latest batch of listener questions. On today's episode, we're asking whether MLS should pause for international breaks. We're debating the use of rolling subs. And we're asking why Newcastle aren't better than they are. My name's Ryan Bailey, Power Trio on TSS today. Joining me, Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ryan. How are you? Are you still trying to tell me that the Belgium Tintin kit is actually bad rather than one of the best kits at Euro 2024, which is obviously the correct opinion? Defend yourself, Ryan.
I am trying to tell you that, Graham. Confirmed. Belgium played in their friendlies this week, or certainly in a friendly against England on Tuesday, in sky blue shirt. Yep, good, good, very good, all good. Brown shorts.
Brown shorts. It wouldn't be Tintin without the brown shorts. It would just be a blue shirt. That's the whole point of it.
I don't care if it's Snowy, Tintin, or any of those lovely, adorable characters. Brown shorts, Graham.
I think I own a couple pair of brown shorts. Also, all I'm saying is, if England had played in brown shorts, Gary Lineker would have saved himself a lot of trouble.
Very nice. Joe Lowry, how are you doing today, sir?
I am doing great. We are off to a hot start around here. It's good to see you, fellas.
Joe Lowry, brown shorts in general. I mean, St. Pauli, I guess, technically playing brown, right?
Didn't know that. I think a brown short can absolutely be the right fit. I don't know that I love the Tintin kit, but I lean closer to Graham than I lean to you.
Yes,
I'm
Joe.
Just down for some experiments, right? Like, let's just have some fun. Let's Guy Fieri this kit. We've done it before with Belgium. Like, let's go off the rails, people. Yeah. I'm ready for it.
Every country should have a novelty, like, film or
and
cartoon
they should
character
all be Guy Fieri.
Kit.
No, what Graham said.
The Scotland Shrek away kit. I would buy that.
Would you buy the Family Guy USMNT shirt?
Yes.
Yeah, just like Stewie's little overalls. That's what you're getting. Yeah.
They should definitely do that.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Excellent stuff. Rather than keep riffing on that, we should probably move on to the main body of the show. No Taylor Rockwell here today, by the way. Another single day luxury cruise he's on. He's such a salty sea dog. Taylor Rockwell.
Still he loves it. Can't stay away.
He loves it. He loves it. Yeah. Graham, by the way, my condolences to you and the situation with Wales, not in the Euros. You're very upset by this development overnight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely distraught. Coming out the Scotland game last night, losing at home to Northern Ireland. Absolutely abysmal performance. Yeah, that just deepened the malaise. No, I'm kidding on. I saw that score and that lifted my mood right up.
You know, lifted my mood. Last international break of the season. Nearly done. Wonderful stuff. Excellent. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show for all our bonus content, by the way. We've got bonus video, access to our Discord, and bonus podcast episodes. Going up on the feed this week, we've got a nice game of Two Truths and a Lie. Good fun game we've got coming up there. And also, the all-time worst Premier League transfer.
Anthony. Whoa, that was weird.
Bless you, Joe. Bless
Sorry.
You. No spoilers, please. No spoilers.
I just sneezed. I don't know what that was.
Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show for that if you would like to support us. Thank you very much indeed. Let's get to the body of this episode. Some listener questions come in here, including this one from Garrett Headley, who says, I'm wondering how much stronger you guys think the USMNT is right now relative to the 2022 World Cup. And realistically, how much stronger the USMNT can be by 2026. 6. Joe, let's start off with the first part of the question. How different is this team from 2022? Surely it's not that long ago, is it? The World Cup 2022. It was like yesterday, right?
It really does feel that way. It's kind of been a while at this point. We're about a year and a half removed from the World Cup. And some things have changed for the U.S. men's national team. So the top line answer for me on this one from Garrett is that they are noticeably stronger. And here's why I think that. Florin Balogun pretty clearly makes this team stronger, giving them some sort of focal point in the attack. Although I admit, coming off the Nations League is not the dream time for that take. But I still think it's pretty clear that he is the best, most talented player at that spot in the pool and was a justifiably big get and was talked about as so when that move was made by Florin Balogun. Chris Richards wasn't at that World Cup, lest we forget. He was injured. I talked to them after the World Cup, and he was heartbroken about all that. And I think it's very clearly, despite a poor Nations League as well, very clearly one of the guys at center back for the United States. But really, it is Gio Reyna's development within this team and the fact that, you know, seems like he will actually be able to be on the field come 2026 that makes them strongest by the biggest margin. So I think it is those three things. A lot of the other key pieces were there. The U.S., let's not forget, largely was injured, like heading into the World Cup. Various international windows, we almost never saw the top young players on the field together because when Gio Reyna was healthy, Tyler Adams wasn't. And when Tyler Adams wasn't healthy, you know, maybe Weston McKennie was. And when Weston wasn't healthy, I mean, you can just go down the list, right? You almost never saw that core group together. So very, very infrequently, and we almost had it at the World Cup, and then all the Reyna nonsense went down. So trouble's there, but I do think this team will be pretty clearly better at a handful of positions come 2026. The flip side is that they still got an uphill battle to make any sort of a deep run. Like, this team lost in the round of 16 in 2022. Would anybody be surprised if they lost in the round of 16 in 2026? I wouldn't. Like, I would not be surprised at all. Add in the fact that you now have a different tournament format with a round of 32, which makes it even more difficult to progress and, like, tosses in a weird extra wrinkle of a knockout game where, you know, you could have a Saudi Arabia-Argentina happen to you. I don't think the U.S. has done enough between 2022 and where we are now for anybody to feel markedly better about their chances of making a deeper run in 26.
You've just depressed me, making me think about the round of 32, Joe. Thank you very much.
I hadn't fully considered that. I mean, obviously there's going to be a round of 32, but that does change the equation a little bit.
Yeah. Mm. It means that England will go out to Germany a round earlier than expected at the next World Cup.
We can only dream.
I'm in favour.
Yeah.
You've just won me over.
Graham, your thoughts on this one? How much better is this team than the 2022 edition?
So I agree that it's stronger. I'm maybe not quite as bullish as Joe is on how much stronger it is.
I've said they wouldn't make it any further.
No, but at the start you said they were clearly stronger. And I agree they're stronger. I think they're incrementally stronger. I just had to consider a few kind of things. You hit a lot of the points that I've got in my notes, Joe. Gio Reyna, this is maybe recency bias, but we've just come out of a window where he was very much the difference maker for the US. I think him being in a better place within the squad makes the US stronger than it was at the World Cup on its own. Balogun, of course, being American. Now, there are some integration things with Balogun, and we haven't seen the best of him for the national team. And at club level, things have cooled off for him as well. But I think most would agree the pool is stronger for having Balogun in it. Maybe the biggest difference for me is Christian Pulisic and the fact that he's not rotting away at Chelsea anymore. He's in form. He's got his swagger back. He's sort of rediscovered himself again. And that is huge for the US. I think in midfield as well, Kellen Acosta has essentially been traded for Johnny Cardoso, who has been excellent for Real Betis since joining in January. And the caveat there is Johnny hasn't really had much of an opportunity to show what he can do for the national team. But nonetheless, I think that is probably a bit of an upgrade. I think there are some players who are in a worse place. Not many of them, but Matt Turner, I think, is maybe in a worse place now than he was at the World Cup. Tyler Adams as well, although that one is due to injury more than anything else. But yeah, on balance, I would agree. The US is probably stronger now than it was 18 months ago. The second part of Garrett's question about how strong the US can get by 2026, I find that almost impossible to answer, just because you're probably relying on an unforeseen thing, like an elite-level dual national centre-back choosing to play for the US. That would move the needle. Or Jalen Neal moving to the Premier League and thriving and taking a giant step forward in his development. Something like that, that's like a sort of unforeseen thing over the next couple of years, I think has to happen. I mean, looking at what is within Berhalter's control, getting Reyna and Balogun more reps together would move the needle a tiny bit if we saw more of a connection between those two. Maybe the depth gets a bit better with guys like Diego Luna, Who else? Aidan Morris, Jalen Neal all taking a step up before 2026, so maybe the squad is a bit better to handle the tournament. So those are the things that I'd be looking at. But to Joe's point about pushing the US from where they are currently and where in 2022 to a point where they can make a really deep run, you are looking at one or two elite level players coming out of nowhere to join that team. And I just can't predict that, obviously.
Yeah, or a little over 2 years to go. There are some starting 11 places that can very much shift in a two-year period for an international team. So that
the big one is centre-back, right? There is a reason I said a dual national comes out of nowhere to play at centre-back. That feels like coming out of this Nations League window, pretty much every position is kind of nailed down now, with the exception of the central defenders. Tim Ream, you would say, has maybe got one of those positions nailed down for the Copa America, but is he going to play in 2026? Not sure about that. So that is the one area of the team that they could really use, a generational player coming through.
Agreed, Graham. I think that would be a huge help. I don't know who that player is. You mentioned Jalen Neal. Like, there are other talented youngsters, but there's still a lot of work to be done in that spot for the United States. The other thing that I think it's hard to discount is how important depth is for the U.S. And I do believe strongly that the depth has improved since the World Cup. Graham, you mentioned Acosta not being part of this team anymore. I think about Christian Roldan or Walker Zimmerman or Aaron Long, all players who were on the World Cup roster for the United States. Like, not guys that you feel incredible about being on the field in a World Cup game. Now, instead of some of those players, you're getting stronger. You're getting stronger in midfield. You're getting stronger in various parts of the field. There still needs to be more of that happens, though. And that's the key. I think about someone like Luka Kolejosho, a dual national winger, who could decide to be part of the U.S. men's national team. That would be a big help. I think of someone like Diego Luna, who could do a somewhat passable Gio Reyna impression in the final third when he's on the field, if he continues to develop at his current trajectory. There are other dominoes that can sort of fall and trigger some really good things to happen for the U.S., but I think when you look at this group, because, Graham, I agree, I think the starting 11 is largely nailed down. Between even now and not just the Copa America, but also 2026, I think a lot of the progress, knowing that there isn't a truly elite world-class player in any position just waiting to come out of the woodwork, at least not in the next few years, knowing that the real area to improve with this group is with the depth. And we have seen improvement between 2022 and now, and we will likely see at least some more improvement between now and 26. But if Gio Reyna can't go, and we saw this in the Nations League window, if Gio Reyna or Tyler Adams or Serginho Dest can't go, like, this team looks a lot different and largely a lot worse. So there are question marks there as well.
There are indeed. But Graham, I'm glad to see you agree the difference makers currently in the team are England's Gio Reyna and England's Christian Pulisic. I call him England's Christian Pulisic because, of course, we know he developed his soccer skills while living in England, which we've established.
Sure,
canon,
of course.
Yes, yeah. Excellent stuff. Gareth, thank you very much for that question. We go now to Rob Ledford, who says, "Hello, guys. My team, Atlanta United, missed 6 players from the game this weekend due to the international team call-ups and have several others that have also been called up in the past. This summer looks like the perfect storm of international call-ups with the Euros, Copa America, and the Olympics. Is this the year that MLS has to rethink playing through international breaks and big summer tournaments?" Graham, on MLS wrap-up on Saturday, Liam McHugh, when he was opening the show, said there were over 100 players not available on those Saturday slate of games this past Saturday.
Wow.
According to my math, that's nearly 10 teams worth of players. That's quite a lot being out for a major league, is it not?
Yeah, it is quite a lot. I watched wrap up. I hadn't clocked that was the total number of missing players. Also, referees missing from MLS.
Not
but they're
all.
Back. I think they're going to be back. Yeah, which is good news because the weekend was a bit of a shambles. I know that you had a front row seat to one of those shambolic refereeing performances at the weekend. Right.
Yeah.
Dreadful stuff.
Maybe.
But anyway, back to the question. There are two things in MLS that I actually have to mentally ignore because if I think about them, I have a real problem with them. One of them is the lopsided schedule. I've said that before in the show, but it really, really bothers me. The other thing is how the league just plays through international windows. And the reason I link those two things in my mind, the lopsided schedule and the international window thing, is because of both of those things, it prevents you from getting a true read of how good a team is. So Atlanta, for example, without primarily Almada and Giakoumakis against TFC on Saturday, that's not a true reflection of that team. You can obviously be without players because of injuries, but injuries in my mind are just, they're part of sport. Having two clashing calendars, that feels like a problem that could be avoided, potentially, and countless leagues around the world do avoid it. So I don't know what the solution is, because winter MLS has this winter-to-winter schedule, and there's just too many teams and too many matches to have much flexibility, and obviously you have issues with the climate, which I fully accept. I guess there might be some people looking at the USL Super League, the USL SL, of course, which is going to have a more European-style schedule when it kicks off later this year. So I think there might be some people looking at that to see how that works, and if that experiment works, then I don't know, in theory, maybe at some point in the future MLS goes August to May and this issue works itself out, but that doesn't feel likely anytime soon. I don't know if it would be possible for example, what's a team that has bad inclement
Minnesota
in the winter, Montreal, or Minnesota or whoever, yeah. If they could start their season with like a month on the road, I don't know
Montreal
if there was
doing that
be
right
a potential
now.
Solution
yeah.
there, but... Yeah, so that might be how it sorts itself out, but it is something that bothers me, and it's slightly farcical every time it happens.
Yeah, Joe, you have to think, for a league to be taken seriously on the world stage, it can't be playing through international breaks with the ambition that MLS has, surely. But also, on the flip side, as Graham mentioned, where do you play those games if you don't have the international breaks? And don't take away my beloved Leagues Cup, please. No.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, and MLS has only made it more complicated over time. My answer to Rob's question about is this the year MLS has to rethink playing through international breaks and big summer tournaments? No. Like the answer is absolutely no. It's too late. Like, it's far too late now. And if this summer wasn't enough, like, I don't think there will ever be... I shouldn't say ever. I think it is unlikely that at any point in the near future there will be a year that is enough to encourage MLS to shift their schedule. Now, the caveat there is the 2026 World Cup. Yeah.
2026.
And Don Garber, I was at the State of the League press conference back in December in Columbus at Lower.com Field, and Don Garber said, quote, he can't imagine MLS would be playing games during the 2026 World Cup. They can't imagine, there's the quote part. But, like, they will not be playing in 2026 during the World Cup. They will pause. I assume that means they will cut Leagues Cup that year. But truly, I don't know, because there are a few things MLS loves more than Leagues Cup, as we've all come to learn. But in general, I see no evidence that Major League Soccer is going to shift things. Like, the Olympics, not really a big deal soccer-wise on the men's side. The Copa America and the Euros happen at almost the exact same time. You basically just have one MLS, like, one summer tournament or one window over the summer that MLS is worried about. So I don't know what the deal is. I don't know what's going to happen down the road. But I think if the calendar is ever going to shift, and the weather makes this really, really difficult. Graham, you mentioned the USL Super League. You look at the markets that they've targeted, or the vast majority of the markets that they've targeted, and they are trying to make it as easy, and as they should, if they want to go with this calendar, they're trying to make it as easy for themselves as possible to not have to deal with a lot of winter, and they are going to take a midseason break and all that stuff. And maybe that is something for MLS to look at. I do think if the calendar is ever going to shift, it will have to be incentivized by finances. Like, if you can get roughly similar local attendances during international breaks, MLS doesn't really care a ton about what the outside perception of the league is in terms of whether it makes them look bad or not. And it does, because not enough people are paying attention to the league anyway. Like, we can sit here and talk about how frustrating it is and how it devalues the regular season. The regular season doesn't matter anyway. Like, all these things are very real problems that MLS doesn't seem to care about. And if they're ever going to care, it is going to have to be financially motivated. And I think it's going to have to be financially motivated specifically when it comes to player movement. I'm thinking about transfers. MLS is, at its core, disadvantaged by having their primary transfer window in the winter. MLS's big transfer window, the one where teams are setting their rosters for the regular season, happens in the winter. In Europe, where the best players play, that transfer window happens in the summer. Those things are like diametrically opposed, and it makes moving, I don't know, take a young, talented Argentine international playmaker who happens to play for Atlanta United, Rob's team, it makes transferring Thiago Almada for $35 million or whatever the valuation that Atlanta United's put on him, it makes that really hard, because your two choices are sell him in the winter, where teams don't really want to spend $35 million. We saw that in Europe this year across big leagues, certainly in the Premier League. We saw this elsewhere as well. Or sell him in the summer when everybody wants to spend money on players and you're going to have to find somebody to replace your superstar, and so that your team doesn't go off the rails before the playoffs start. Like, it is a nightmare situation. And until there are more Thiago Almadas, where owners are leaving, you know, seven figures or more on the table in some of these big-time transfer deals, and they realize that, I think until that happens, there just isn't any real motivation inside of MLS to shift the schedule. And I want to be clear, I know I've been talking for a long time, it's a difficult proposition. Like, it's not as simple as saying, just go change the schedule. Like, the weather and the size of the United States is not something that any elite or any, like, even close to elite league around the world has to deal with. Like, this is a unique problem for Major League Soccer. I'm not saying it's unsolvable, but I think it's foolish of anybody to just, you know, come out and say, oh, it's easy, they should just change the schedule. Like, here's the solution, bing, bang, boom. Like, it is not as easy as that. Now, I'm not saying MLS's motivation is always necessarily in the right place to grow the game or the smartest thing, but I don't think we're going to see this calendar shift for any reason outside of the money side, likely of the transfer business.
One thing that I hadn't considered, Joe, from this question until you started talking there was the finances of attendances and attracting crowds. So I don't have any data in front of me, but just anecdotally, I'd imagine Minnesota United, to take them as an example, we'll find it much easier to sell tickets in the summer, playing through the summer, than they would if they were playing through the depths of winter. So you need to make, to your point, the financial case to these owners. Why is it beneficial to shift to a more European-style calendar? Otherwise, they won't care.
And the one solution that at least I noted from Garber's State of the League address is that he said, quote, should we be thinking about playing in a single destination for a period of time during the winter months where you can't play necessarily in Toronto or in Kansas City or in Chicago or New York or Boston? Who knows? Maybe that might be the answer. I don't know if I love or hate that idea of like maybe doing an MLS's back style single location thing.
Back to Orlando, baby. They've still got the set.
I respect that it's a creative solution. You guys would love the Orlando trip. Let's not lie.
Yeah.
Like I respect that it's like a creative solution. It's one that I hadn't really considered much before. You could do it for maybe a month and you carefully craft the schedules around it. And that way teams are losing what? That'd be two home games each. If you assume a game every weekend and one's a home game, one's an away game. Like it would have to make sense financially because that is not an insignificant amount of money coming in from game day revenue, but it's interesting. So I think the wheels are turning with MLS, but I don't think those wheels are going to be prompted by any sort of international tournaments in the long term.
Joe, would you be in favor of MLS building its own island and then playing games on MLS Island for a portion of the season?
We can have a Survivor.
Yeah.
Go on.
Thunderbirds. Oh. I know you're a big fan of Survivor, Joe.
Yeah,
we could
absolutely
have like a Survivor Apple TV.
I was going to say only if there's series. A reality TV bent to it. If this is the Drive to Survive-esque documentary that's been promised, I am all
something
about this.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So am I.
Let's start
make
it
happen.
MLS is blind, like I love his... Oh. No, that's not it. That's not it. Rob, thank you very much for that question. We take a quick break. When we come back, plenty more. Back shortly.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Ira Jersey has been in touch. Hello, Ira. Your lower division club has funding to build a new stadium, says Ira. Good hypothetical so far, Graham. Looking forward to this one. What is one amenity your stadium must have? One amenity that would be nice to have, and one amenity that would be great if possible. You can't have the same ones, says Ira, which is tricky because we haven't shared notes. and a bonus question, stands in the stadium, not covered, covered, or a mixture? Perhaps we can address that one first, by the way, because that is very geography specific, is it not, Graham? In the UK, there are very few uncovered stands. There is only one I can think of, and that is in Gillingham in Kent, where it is the worst away stand in the country because it's uncovered, and everyone hates going there because the weather's bad. But in Charlotte here, I love having an uncovered stand. So that's depends where your lower division club is based, I would say.
So you're talking about stands as in like a seated stand, I would assume, because obviously you get terraces, and the terraces are quite commonly uncovered. But I if I had the choice, I would always choose a covered, even a terrace. Like Queen of the South have a big terrace that's got a cover over it, which is quite rare in Scottish football to have a terrace with a roof. It's great. So I would always pick a, like, just have the option, I guess, to have a roof. But yes, you're right. If you're in a place where the sun shines like semi-regularly, which I am not, then maybe a roofless stand would be good.
Joe, roof or no roof?
No roof. I don't care. I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't been to enough outdoor games like that to have like a great feel for it. So I go with the British folks and their opinions on this one.
Okay. Wonderful stuff. Good attitude to have there, Joe. I will run through, if you don't mind, I'll run through my must-haves, nice-haves, and great-haves on my...
Graham, do we?
Do you mind?
Okay. I mean a little bit, but I'll concede.
All right, go ahead, Graham.
Oh, Graham's going to allow it. Good. So I'm going to go through my choices. Obviously, the must-have is a cheese room and a tunnel club, right? We're all agreed that we need those things in our state.
No, I don't even know if you're joking.
What's a tunnel club?
Kidding.
I don't know what that is.
A tunnel club? It's like glass either side of the tunnel, and you executives pay a lot of money to watch the teams go in and out, and players get sent off occasionally.
That's kind of weird, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's a whole thing, Joe. As is a cheese room, which, of course... does Tottenham have a cheese room, or was it rumoured to have a cheese room?
I think it was in the original plans, and then they scrapped it.
Yeah, because that plan stank. Huh? Cheese, good. Anyway, so my lower division team, my must-have, and this is a genuine one, its own bar. This I have learned from Plough Lane, AFC Wimbledon Stadium. Very good to generate atmosphere and revenue on a match day. But for a low division team, having a bar that's open outside of match days that you can access from the street, very important to generate revenue and a sense of community for your lower division club, making it a venue for non-soccer fans and soccer fans alike. So that is my must-have if you're going to open a lower division stadium. My nice-to-have... community facilities. I'm talking a gym, I'm talking extra training areas, I'm talking any facilities that the local community can use and take part in and share with the club. Obviously,
the Fulham model, the swimming pool on the roof and the gentleman's club, that's the kind of community facilities you're talking about, right?
Gentleman's club? In what? What?
Yeah,
that's... Is that a thing in
Fulham stand?
Wow.
Their new stand has a whole lot of stuff in it.
Sure, Graham. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about community facilities. A gentleman's club in the stadium, yes. No, I mean, basically stuff, because once again, I'm thinking about the community aspect of a lower division club. That's one of the most important things about a lower division club, bringing the community together and helping everybody and having community facilities. So like a gym that everybody can use at certain times of the week, I think is very important. And could even be a revenue generator if that arrangement is in place. My great, if possible, to have, Graham, Wi-Fi. That's it.
Oh, that's a good one.
Just for checking the scores at halftime when everyone's doing the same thing and you can't get on the network. Wi-Fi. There you go. Yeah.
That is good, because I hate it when you can't get a signal at a stadium. Hampden is the worst for this. I was at the Scotland game last night and you guys were putting messages in Slack. I didn't get them until hours afterwards because I was in the Hampden Park black hole in more than one way, but with Wi-Fi and signal.
All right, Graham, would you like to talk about your low division club and your must-haves for the stadium you're building?
Okay, so I'm not going to surprise anyone with my must-have, but it's
pie
good
shed,
catering.
Pie shed, pie shed.
Essentially, yes, a pie shed. It is a big part of the experience for me. I look forward to my pie, and when it's a bad pie, cough, Hamilton Accies, that's a real bummer. So good catering is a must-have for me, and obviously at lower league level, you're not going to have, like, what, a Bojangles inside the stadium or anything. So just focus on doing a few things really well. So obviously pies aren't really a thing in American soccer, although they should be. So maybe like your option should be a good cheeseburger with some good toppings, a good veggie option, and then like a rotating speciality option. That's all you need. You don't need to have a big menu. Just do a few things well, and that'll do.
Food trucks, Graham. How about an alley of food trucks like AFC Wimbledon has?
See, that would be good before the match. The thing that you showed me on the Patreon at Wimbledon looked fantastic. But during the match, bit messy. I don't know. Feel like stadium food needs to... I've got my theory and my rules, Ryan. You know about them. They need to be held in one hand so that I can abuse the referee with the other hand. Which I presume you sympathise with, that stance after last weekend.
Indeed.
Your Bojangles was just getting in the way of abusing the replacement refs.
No comment. Nice to have.
Nice to have. Oh, you stole my nice to have, and I'm not allowed to use the same one. I had a social club, which is essentially the same thing, a bar attached to the stadium that you can go to on non-match days. So I will say I'll move up my great if possible, and that is the ability for fans to move all the way around the pitch. I love lower league grounds where if you're a fan, you can stand behind the goal your team is shooting into one half, and then for the other half, you can move to the other side of the pitch, to the other goal for the second half. And I also love when two sets of fans walk past each other and they're sort of like an awkward, all right, how's it going? Yeah, you were lucky to get a penalty there. I just find it like a really charming feature.
So Graham just likes it because there's more opportunities for abuse. That's what he's talking about towards the opposing fans. So are there not people sitting on the other side? Like, how are you going to move seats mid-game when they're... I'm so confused.
All standing, Joe. All standing, baby.
So how is that not like a hazard in terms of, like, how do you not just double it? I don't understand this at all. This makes no sense to me.
Joe, there's not that many people inside the stadium.
Well, assume Ira wants people at his games, Graham.
Honestly, it works fine. You just, what normally happens is you walk around different sides of the pitch. So they would walk around that side and you'd walk around the other side.
Right. I guess I'm less concerned about the walking and more concerned about, like, what if people don't want to move and there's just twice as many people in one end and zero people in the other?
Well, that's fine.
Joe, you have to trust that in practice this kind of works.
Okay. It does. It honestly does. It's just part of the accepted protocol of stadiums like this where you shift. You move to the
other. And once again, Graham wants to do it so he can abuse the opposing goalkeeper.
Right. That's always recovered on that front.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Scottish. This is what I do. It's at my core. I have no idea what to put for my great if possible because now I have run out of one. Why not? Club shop. Club shop in the ground, actually, because... At the Scotland game last night, I've noticed this a few times about Hampden, there's literally nowhere to buy merchandise inside the stadium. There's a merchandise van outside the ground. But once you get into the ground, there's nowhere to buy a shirt, which is fine because I don't want to buy that new shirt anyway. But normally it's a problem. So yeah, a club shop inside the ground, crucially.
I like that. The Stadio Olimpico, no club shop, Graham, because I guess they didn't want to have two of them for two different teams anyway.
Yeah, do what they do at Milan. I'm pretty sure it's Milan. It might not be Milan, where they have like the shutters. They spin it round like the club shop. They spin all the displays round for one match and then spin them back round for another match. I like that.
Awkward if they forget. Joe, your lower division club and must-haves, nice-haves, great-to-haves.
All right, I'll go from bottom to top. So the great-to-have, if it's possible, and I sort of differ with Graham on this. It's a food option. That's why I want to start with it because we've kind of touched on food already. The other two have not been mentioned yet. I think it's cool to have pop-ups from, like, good local restaurants that people know. Like, if you're starting this from scratch, I don't know that all this is necessarily ideal stadium food, which is where I do take your point, Graham, but I think that could be a cool way to tie to the community. Ryan, you mentioned the gym or other ways to tie into the local community, especially if you're trying to, like, generate some momentum here, finding existing things inside of the community that you can tie to your club and strengthen
Bianco
those ties within the community.
Phoenix Rising Games.
Do it. Make it happen, Graham. I would be incredible. I like that idea. Like, I like the idea of trying to strengthen some of those bonds, and I think people will respond to that as well. So that's my great to have, if it's possible. My nice to have, and really for me this is a must have, but you know, we'll downgrade it one level. Good camera angle. Like, if you're gonna have a camera in your stadium, if you're gonna have a stadium, put your camera in a good spot so that people can see the game. Like Bournemouth, I think about Bournemouth in the Premier League, their camera angle is basically on the pitch, and it is absolutely atrocious. I think about Lynn Family Stadium is a beautiful stadium that Racing Louisville and Louisville City use in American soccer. The camera angle is truly wretched. It is really, really poor, and it will be the home of...
Is that an amenity? I'm not sure.
I think it's an amenity. It's part of the general stadium experience, and fans will absolutely notice over time. I may be stretching here slightly, but I think it's really, really important to have that, because it makes the experience for people as you try to grow a brand of a club amongst local fans and fans beyond. I think it's really, really important, because it's fun to watch games that you can actually see what's happening. And then a must have, lots of bathrooms. Like, I think you need to figure out a way to have lots of bathrooms in and around a stadium. Like, the worst thing is people having to leave before halftime starts or whatever, because they know the line for the bathroom is going to be long. Like, you want people in your seats, in your stadium, for as long as possible. And sort of along with that, a really clear-cut transportation situation. I don't know how big of a problem that is in parts of Europe, but out here in Carville, like, you got to have places to put cars, or like really clear busing strategies or whatever, because people are going to leave 10 minutes early from your game because they don't want to sit in a line of traffic for an hour. It's a real problem out here in Phoenix. I imagine that's a problem that's shared by other lower level clubs around the United States. Those sorts of amenities, bathrooms, parking, I think really important.
I'm picturing the Joe Lowry Bathroom Stadium, just stalls lining the entire stadium.
Oh, wait, that's in the floating stadium. Yeah, fans are legally not allowed to move from their seats, certainly not to go to the other side, but only because we also know that they'll have time to go to the bathroom.
Is the local foods suggestion linked to the bathroom suggestion? Like, if there's local foods like curry or Taco Bell.
I didn't intend for them to be related, Graham, but now that you've brought that up, I think we could draw some sort of line there, yes.
Yeah. Oh boy, that seems like a good jumping off point for this question. Ira, thank you very much indeed for that one. We go to Andrew McPherson now. What effect would implementing basketball-style substitutions, unlimited but only at stoppages, what would that have on the Sockers? Joe, as far as I can tell, I don't object to this idea, but probably the biggest impact this would have, from my perspective, would be penalty and dead ball specialists coming on and off. I think you'd have players like your kicker in the NFL who maybe would just come on. They could be in their 40s or something. Just come.
Charlie Adam is still playing for Man City.
There you go. What do you think, Joe? Is that a big impact?
I think it probably would be. I didn't even think about the set piece side of things, but imagine James Ward-Prowse is like a little banged up or whatever, and you slap him on the field for a minute, and you bring him back off at the next stoppage. I can see this working really well. It would extend Leo Messi's career if he wants it for another like decade. Exactly. Yeah. That's a fascinating one. The way my brain took this question is two directions. We can sort of see what effect this would have, because we see it in college soccer here in the United States, where basically you have unlimited subs. There are more restrictions on that, and I think there's some changes coming to that rule, at least on the men's side. But it slows the game down, for one. And I think one of soccer's biggest assets visually is that it is a very fluid game. I don't think mechanically this is something that I'm ever interested in happening, and so I think it would slow the game down from a viewer's perspective. Tactically, in terms of the on-field impact, the biggest thing for me is that we would see way more pressing teams. Like, if all of a sudden you can press in 30-minute shifts with your front six or whatever, and maybe you keep the back line on, I don't know what it is, right? Maybe you take the fullbacks off or whatever. But I think we would see more and more teams start to press, and it's possible that as we saw that, we would see, you know, tactical changes, because tactics are cyclical in the sport in a lot of ways. But I think the first reaction on the field from managers would be to encourage their teams to press more, because you don't have to worry about fitness. Like, as long as you have capable depth, you can rotate in sort of platoons and have one group and then the next group and then the next group. And I think teams would very quickly start to be more and more aggressive in their pressing.
I like it. Graham, do you concur?
Yeah, perhaps. I think you could take this question in any direction you like. My honest answer to Andrew's question is I don't know, because I think it could change football quite fundamentally. I've got some theories on how it would change it. I sort of wonder if you would get teams making changes like an NFL team, whether there are defensive and attacking phases. Like, would you bring on another couple big defenders for a big corner kick when you're defending a 1-0 lead? and then bring them off again once the corner's been defended. I think you would. I think it could change football being a two-way sport and turn it into a sport with more of a playbook with different phases. I think it would also become really difficult to track, just talking as a viewer here, what teams are doing tactically and how they're responding to what the opposition is doing. Because by the time you figure it out and respond, they'll probably have changed again. So I don't know if there would be a lot of continuity, or at least that would be a threat from this. Obviously, this kind of already happens with managers responding and making tactical tweaks and so on, but it would just give managers another way to change things up and maybe the truly tactically astute would rise to the top even more prominently, because I think this could get quite messy quite quickly. I also feel like TV broadcasts would have to find a way to actually display who was on the field at any given time. I know basketball doesn't really do this, but there's 11 players on a football team, so 22 players on a pitch, and if they're interchanging all the time from a squad of like 25 or however big the bench makes the squad, I feel like we'd need a way to track that in some way. So purely as a viewer, I'm not in favour of this. Potentially you would get higher quality football matches, certainly from a fitness point of view. I take Joe's point on pressing, but as a viewer, I'm not convinced this would improve football as a product.
Yeah, I said at the start of this question, I don't object to it, but you've both turned me around on that. I hate this idea now.
Graham, I think your point about it, like making soccer look more like American football in this sort of basketball conversation, is fascinating. I think you're kind of right. Like every dead ball situation, and those don't come nearly as often as American football, obviously, but every dead ball situation, and Ryan, you got to this as well, would be an opportunity to completely reshuffle your 11. And all of a sudden you might have like coaches who are just studying the substitution patterns and trends of their opponents to know who the big like free kicks from the right side of the field subs are, and who the, like, I mean, it would get so much more American football-y and like almost play call-y. And I just don't think that's probably a move for soccer. Not that Andrew's suggesting that in the question, but I think we're all sort of on the same page that this would really, really change the sport.
It would. I think, Joe, we'd end up with, in an NFL games, you quite often get like too many players on the field, right? That happens an alarming amount. And we'd have to constantly be counting the players on the field too, which would be exhausting. Hate it. Andrew, thank you very much for the question. A great question. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're asking about Newcastle and why they ain't better. And we're also going to give Joe the floor to explain why he hates managers so much. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show's listener questions. We're back with Kevin Tolley, who says, WTF Newcastle? I thought they were better than they apparently are. Graham, what's going on with Newcastle? 10th, they're firmly in that Chelsea zone of underachievement at the moment. 3 losses in the last 5 games. Lots of injuries, obviously, but given their resources and the bottomless pile of cash they have access to, probably no excuse for how they're doing this year, and given also how they performed last year as well, it's a bit of a downturn, is it not?
Yeah, I think injuries have obviously been a factor, but I also believe there is more going on here. There's more to their downturn than just unavailable players. It has undeniably been a difficult season for Newcastle, who didn't make it out of their Champions League group despite some good results there. They went out in the quarterfinals of both cups. Not a disgrace, but nonetheless, they're not going to win a trophy this season, and they're 10th in the Premier League. I sort of did project this in a way. So at the start of the season, I remember we spoke about which big manager could get sacked in the Premier League this season. And my nomination was Eddie Howe, which hasn't happened, of course. But my theory checks out, which was I thought there would be a drop-off this season. I also predicted Newcastle would make the latter rounds of the Champions League. So these predictions kind of cancel each other out. But anyway, in terms of the Premier League, I think this was in some way predictable. What maybe hasn't been so predictable has been the drop-off in their defence. So that was Newcastle's big strength last season, was their defensive line, their defensive record. I think it was the second strongest defensive record in the Premier League last season. They're now conceding nearly double the number of goals per match this season compared to last. Listen to this for a drop-off. So last season, Newcastle, in terms of non-penalty expected goals conceded per game, were second in the Premier League. This season, for the same metric, only Luton Town and Sheffield United are below them. That is a huge, huge drop. Gone from basically the best in the Premier League to the worst in the space of a season. They have looked so vulnerable to the counter-attack as well. This is where I think maybe opposition teams are a little bit wiser to how they can expose them. We hear that term, figuring out a team. Maybe that's happened a little bit in Newcastle's case, because they are conceding a lot of goals on fast break. They're conceding more shots per game in general. So that's where I think the big difference has been. Newcastle United, as an attacking outfit, were never really that exhilarating to watch last season. Their strength was in defence, and this season that strength has completely gone. I also think last season was a bit of an overperformance, not in terms of the underlying numbers, because their underlying numbers were actually really solid if you look through the metrics, but in terms of having a squad of players that was performing individually and as a collective at such a high level, maybe beyond their usual capabilities. So I look at players like Sean Longstaff, who's been one of the injuries this season, but last season played at an incredibly high level that I think, to be honest, is maybe a little bit beyond him, and there will be and there has been a revert to the default from him. So there are a number of different factors there, and once you add in European football and the pressures of that and the added fixtures into that schedule, yeah, this was always good. It was always going to be difficult for them to maintain their level from last season. But even factoring that in, yeah, it's been quite the shocking drop-off, dramatic drop-off.
Yeah, Joe, I suppose our expectations are higher because they're rich. But does this not speak, the current position they're in, does it not speak to the fact that they're perhaps being a bit more methodical than some people would like, that they are not going out and spending silly money left, right and centre? They are building something with maybe some nous behind it. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And it also seems fair to say that along those same lines, they are a little concerned about the profitability and sustainability regulations that we're seeing actually have a little bit of might in the Premier League right now, where teams are being deducted some points. Man City are still sort of dancing.
Not if you're nation state, yeah, no, Joe. Well, it doesn't work like that.
And that's the interesting point here, Ryan, is other clubs are concerned about this, and Newcastle, at least publicly, have been cautious and have like acknowledged that in quotes from some of their front office members. Darren Eales, former Atlanta United chief, like one of those people who's talked a bit about this. I don't know. They don't seem as eager to just kind of push through and claim innocence like Man City. They have been a bit more patient. And according to those regulations, they haven't had a lot of financial wiggle room. And there's reasons why we didn't see a ton of reinforcements come in January. So you toss the lack of real spending to continue to upkeep their squad. You toss that into the fact that they had more games to play this year. They were in the Champions League. That takes a real toll on your players and on your squad when you just add more games and you don't get a ton stronger as the season progresses. You toss that into the injury mashup that they've had. And Grammy mentioned some of those players, like Newcastle have had a lot of injuries, likely because some of those players are carrying heavier loads because of increased fixtures. Also because Sandro Tonali, not available in midfield, suspended. Like, there are a lot of issues here. I looked up and again, take the salary data we can find online with a grain of salt, but I looked up the wage data for Newcastle right now. And according to SpotRack, which is what I could find online, they have the 9th highest wage bill in the Premier League. They are 10th in the league. Those things line up pretty similarly. Like, we know, one of the things that we think we know about soccer, and we don't know a lot in terms of how to predict success, one of the things that we think we know is that in high-level European leagues, wages are the strongest correlator to success. If your team spends a lot, not on transfer fees, on wages. If your team spends a lot on what you're paying players every week, makes sense. Generally speaking, the better players are going to be the ones that ask for more money. You can sort of see why this is. But generally speaking, the teams that spend more on the wages of their players are the teams that are finishing higher up the table. There are outliers, obviously. If you spend the money in really stupid ways, like Chelsea, you're probably not going to finish that high up the table. So there are caveats here. It's not a perfect one-to-one correlation between spending on wages and success and points, but that is a real thing. And Newcastle still, according to at least the data that we have, and you can sort of intuit this when you look at the squad, are just not there yet. And I don't think they strengthened at the rate that they're place in the table last year would indicate to sustain that success moving forward.
Okay. They're not there yet, Joe, but do you feel like they'll get there?
It feels inevitable, right? Like with those profitability and sustainability regulations, as they continue to become a more financially successful team, like that will give them more financial flexibility. And so even if they want to operate within those regulations, they can still move forward and continue to become a bigger player. I don't think there is a reality where 5 or 10 years from now, they're not like finishing top six, yeah, you know, 9 of the following 10 seasons. Like that is where this team is headed.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Joe. What I would say, though, is this summer feels like a bit of a crossroads for them as a club. So obviously Dan Ashworth has been their sporting director, credited with a lot of the good transfer stuff that's happened at Newcastle over the last couple of years. It looks like he's going to Manchester United. He's not working for Newcastle United. Certainly he's on gardening leave. I wonder how that garden is getting on. And also, it feels like Newcastle have a decision to make on Eddie Howe and what his future is. Has done a good job at Newcastle, generally. I don't think anyone could argue with that. Took over when Newcastle were facing relegation, took them into the Champions League. Even this season, they're nowhere near relegation trouble. They're comfortably in mid-table, but it feels like there might be higher calibre managers out there that could be more of a difference maker than Eddie Howe.
Have we identified the hotel Jose's going to be living in when he goes to Newcastle, Graham, or not?
I think we should just check the names in Newcastle hotels right now, because he'll probably be living there already, just scoping out St. James's Park.
Excellent stuff. A fine city it is. Good choice, Jose. And thank you, Kevin, for that question. One final one for this episode from Andrew Strong. Joe is constantly talking about how pointless managers are and that they should be eliminated from the game. JK, JK, says Andrew. But he often does talk about managers influencing less than we think. Joe, can you unpack that, asks Andrew. He thinks of managers like Vlatko, Jurgen Klopp, Klinsmann, Pep Guardiola as some examples as managers that seem to make a difference for good or for bad. So, Joe, I suppose as a way into this conversation, what I'd like to ask you is, how important is leadership in an organization for you? So, like, let's take, I know, Steve Jobs at Apple or Elon Musk at Tesla. For good or for bad, whatever they've done, they've imposed
Ryan's
a leadership style and imposed...
Sorry, what?
How important is leadership to you? Or do you think, the minions get stuff done?
Leadership is important. I think it's a good way to enter into this conversation because it's maybe something that's a bit more applicable to all of us as non-professional athletes and likely to our listeners as well. Maybe there's a few of you all pros out there, in which case, respect. I think leadership is important. If your employees are bad at their jobs, that is a problem. And the same goes with any job, right? Like my general belief as it relates to soccer is that managers matter. Leadership matters. I've never once said that managers don't matter at all. They obviously do. That would be an insane thing to say. My strong belief is that they matter far less than most people think they do, or at least they matter far less than the way it sounds like people think they do, given how they talk about them. They are not chess players. Soccer players are not chess pieces. You read an article, here's an example. Like you read an article, in even sometimes how we talk about managers, right? 9 times out of 10, it's the manager who gets praised for team's performance rather than the players who actually put in the shift outside of maybe a goal scorer or two goal scorers. I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is just like, it's a lot easier to just say, you know, Diego Simeone's masterclass than it is to like go through in detail tactically how the players impacted the game. It's a shortcut. It's a lazy shortcut, frankly, to how we talk about the game. It's an understandable one. But it is lazy and not accurate, you know, nonetheless. So it's just not how soccer works. Like, this is my take, and I'll finish my rant here. Pep Guardiola, one of the people who will be most advantaged by hyping up the importance of managers, because he is one of them, he has been asked about, you know, Pep, what's your secret? Like, how are you so good at this job? And his answer...
Join the biggest clubs, the richest clubs, yeah, and sign the best
His players. Answer, Graham, literally was, have good players. Have good players, have Messi in the past. This is a direct quote. Have Messi in the past, have Haaland now. This is my success. That is a direct quote from a Pep Guardiola press conference. You put 11 Joe Lowrys on the field, and this ties into Ryan, where you led me. You put 11 Joe Lowrys on the field, leadership doesn't matter. Like, we're getting clapped.
Are they coached by Joe Lowry?
If they're coached by Joe Lowry, they're getting clapped. If they're coached by Pep Guardiola, they're still getting clapped. Now, what I will acknowledge, and any sane person would acknowledge, a Pep-coached team of Joe Lowry's will do better than a Joe Lowry-coached team of Joe Lowry's. And that is going back to managers do matter. They have an impact at the extremes. Like, this is, to bring my take to a close, at the extremes, managers can be impactful. Pep coaching 11 Mies would be better than some rando coaching 11 Mies. Pep has clearly studied the game. He gives his teams clear instructions. He has a tactical vision for how he wants them to play. He creates a structure that allows those players to influence the game from within. Those are skills. Wilfred Nancy and MLS has shown, like, if you have a clear vision and can communicate it clearly to your players, if you have some elite talent and some just like slightly above average MLS talent, maybe just some average MLS talent, you can build the best team in the league. So managers do matter. And when managers don't have those skills, their teams suffer. I spent an entire tournament cycle for the U.S. Women's National Team talking about how Vlatko gave the U.S. nothing. He was not giving them clear tactical instructions on the field in the attack, and that was a real problem. When push came to shove in both the Olympics and the World Cup, you could tell that the U.S. had no clear ideas of how they wanted to approach the game in possession. That was a weakness. It came back to bite them. They were a mediocre team relative to their talent throughout that entire tournament cycle, and that was a huge problem that was overlooked by U.S. soccer. Coaching matters. The extremes matter. In the middle, in the mushy middle, like, there's just a whole lot of muck that people, attribute to managers when we should probably actually look at the people that touch the ball instead.
Well, let me ask you this, Andrew. Obviously, you've acknowledged that coaches matter. But when a team needs to make a change, the first change they make is the coach, right?
Because it's the easiest one.
Is it because it's the easiest one? Like, in your, would it be more satisfying for you, Joe, if in those scenarios where a team needs to change and needs to turn its fortunes around, you fired five players instead?
I don't know if it would be more satisfying. I think it would be a better way to turn your team around. Like, if you're trying to transform your team's on-field product, the way you do that is primarily through your players. Now, what I will say is there are a lot of managers who I think are super mediocre and don't have the impact on the games that like someone like Pep or someone like Wilfred Nancy or whoever these are, right? I'm just picking Nancy because he's the best manager relative to the league that I pay the most attention to, right? There are other managers who have had more success. I get that. But like, generally speaking, a manager shift can have a big impact. Like, we see the Columbus Crew go out and ditch Caleb Porter, bring in Wilfred Nancy. They make some changes in the squad as well. But like, he is a huge driver behind their success. You can have that success by swapping managers. But swapping one manager for like another manager that we don't have any evidence is like a real difference maker on the sidelines is foolish. It is saving face. It is not really looking at the problems at face value. Most often the problems with the team are their players are just bad. And instead of firing the coach, maybe you should go out there and fire the sporting director or the general manager, whoever it is, and try to help that person or whoever's going to be occupying that job go out and find better people who are better at the sport like that. So I guess, yes, the answer, Ryan, to your question is yes.
Okay.
I don't know. So let me flip it around to you guys. Do you disagree with any of what I've said, or how do you all envision managers and their impact compared to players, which I think is the interesting part of this conversation?
I'll hand over to Graham shortly. I'll say I don't disagree with anything you've said, Joe, but I actually wonder if managers are more important than we think. Just from anecdotal evidence.
Disagree with what I said.
No, I understand. No, let me say that. I understand your rationale. I understand the rationale of everything you've said. But I just think from anecdotal experience, having a good leader at the top, having a good CEO, having a good boss, changes the culture of everything.
Sure.
And it makes it so important. I believe that 11 Joe Lowry's or 11 Ryan Bailey's can be made a lot better by a good coach.
That's where it becomes really, really difficult to judge managers, right? Because if we're looking at Pep Guardiola, accept that point, Ryan. The point that Joe makes is Pep has good players, but does Pep have good players because those good players want to work with Pep Guardiola? Do they move to Manchester City if he isn't there? But then does Pep Guardiola get those players without the help of Cheeky Boy Bergstein and Ferran Soriano and all those guys who are part of that leadership group at Manchester City? So I just find it really difficult to... And look, we all fall into the routine of judging and assessing managers. It's part of the job. But when you boil it down, I agree with Joe, it is very difficult to judge managers because we only see what happens on the pitch. And that is primarily down to the players. But actually, a manager's role encompasses far more than what happens on the pitch. And we don't see that part.
It is a fascinating point. Like, I'm not trying to undermine the importance of leadership or of a positive culture at a club. Like, those things are super important. And I don't really think you can be... I think it's pretty obvious, actually, that you can't be the best version of yourself as a club without those things being in place. Like, those are important things. To Graham's point, they're really hard to measure, those things. And from my anecdotal experience, as someone who was never very good at soccer, like 11 people who hate each other and are better at soccer than me and who hate being there can still be a better soccer team than 11 Joe Lowry's. Like, 11 elite, like, world-class players who do dislike... Yeah, no, I think the Joe Lowry's would get along mostly okay. Maybe a little annoyed at, like, the random singing and whatnot. But, like, I think 11 very, very high-level players would still be better if they're under a manager who, like, doesn't really enjoy being there and nobody's really all that happy. It's unsustainable. And because it's unsustainable, you're bound to find something better before too long, right? Like, that's the silver lining there. Like, though... That team's still bound to be better on any given day than like a team of just non-elite players. It does increase the chances that the non-elite team will put together some sort of upset. Like, that's why you want to maximize around all the margins. But for me, managers almost always, and probably always, are just that. They are in the margins. An important part of the margins, yes. But the majority of how teams go out there and win games, like, fundamentally, no.
Yeah, I mean, your point, Joe, is that in the vast majority of cases, the primary difference maker for a team is the quality of the players. And
in every case, that is the primary case. But in some cases, the impact of a manager can be larger than others. That's
when
I was
when I was thinking about this question, I tried to think of bad teams that have done great things, or rather, teams with bad players that have done great things, and I struggled, to be honest, because even in the cases of great upsets, and I'm thinking of managers who have pulled off these landmark achievements. I'm thinking of Jose Mourinho at Porto. I'm thinking of Leicester City winning the Premier League title. They had good players. They had players who went and achieved other things at other clubs. You know, Leicester City had Riyad Mahrez and a couple others. Porto had Ricardo Carvalho and Deco and Manish and all these other players who went and achieved other things at other clubs. So even in these instances, the players were the primary difference maker. So I in fact totally agree with Joe's principal point. I think I probably put the percentage of influence that a manager can have at maybe a slightly higher point than Joe does. But if you were to ask me to quantify that, I would struggle as well. Like, I can't give you a percentage point on that. Balance, I can't agree with Joe's broader principle.
And I truly believe that the reason this has happened, and I kind of mentioned this earlier, is just because soccer is so complicated. Like, the reason why managers, I think, culturally have this inflated reputation relative to their, like, pretty obvious lack of impact on games. Other things that managers do that I haven't talked about, they pick lineups. That's super important. Like, that is really, really important. They manage subs. Like, they do have impacts on games. But, like, it is really hard to accurately break down a game. There are 22, 23, if you count the ball, moving pieces and parts on the field at any given time. It's hard to pay attention to. It's like impossible for a human to pay attention to all of them. So it's hard when we're talking about the games, and I fall into this trap. Like, you can't pay attention to everything at the same time. So the easiest thing to do is zoom out 23 layers and look at the manager on the sideline and sort of like talk very generally about what they've done and what the team has done. That is the phenomenon, I think, that has led to how we talk about managers today. And even though it's inaccurate, I also don't really envision it changing all that much anytime soon because of that reason.
I think at the elite level of the game, I'm talking like the top of the Premier League and the Champions League, the talent level from team to team is actually so similar and the margins are so narrow that's where I do think you do get quite an outsized impact from managers. I think players are always going to be the primary difference maker for teams.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's clear there's a lot of nuance to this discussion, isn't it? And it is very case by case. But a very good question, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed for posing it to us. Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow if you want to continue this conversation in our Discord with all the cool kids. But for now, Graham Ruthven, thank you very much for A-ing some cues.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey. Get back in your tunnel club.
Joe Lowry, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Ryan.
And listener, thank you the mostest for joining us on the feed. We'll be back very shortly, but for now, bye!